Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Back-to-back Six Nations champions, 5 match points clear of their nearest rival, 78 points clear in terms of points difference. Unbeaten home record now stretches to 19 games. At the Cauldron, that is the Aviva Stadium, one in the eye for the begrudgers, eh, Murph?
Oh, I'm in that camp, am I?
Ah, well, you were last week. Hey, Simon. Well, no, you weren't begrudging. But you don't begrudge a defeat, I suppose.
No, that's
you were just jumping all over the Irish rugby grave happily.
I feel like that's a misrepresentation on, but you know, it's a bank holiday Monday, you know. I understand if, you know, you're just swinging at the whatever comes closest, you know, you're swinging at me with whatever comes to hand first. I appreciate that on.
He's angry. He's lashing out.
Yeah, he is. He's lashing out all over. I'm delighted. I'm a happy Irishman.
I'm angry we didn't beat the Scots by more. I wanted to hammer the Scots. Anyway, we've got a 3-person punditry team on today. Andrew Trimble, the BBC's Chris Jones, and Tom English of BBC Scotland. This is your one bank holiday podcast today. All the Man United fans listening will need to be signed up to the World Service to hear Ken's football pod tomorrow. I am hoping the Murphy brothers are all signed up already, Ciarán. What a week it's going to be for you lot.
I know.
On the World Service. Tomorrow, the Amad Diallo special. And on Wednesday.
And who wrote it?
I can't remember his name.
I'll tell you who wrote it.
Galway's greatest ever sportsperson, with all due respect to Noel Mannion, Exeter Elwood, yeah, and the Athenry Express, Paul Hessian. Galway's greatest, Joe Canning, is our guest reviewer in our latest episode of the I'll Tell You Wrote It Second Captain's Book Club. You're okay with that characterisation, Murph?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you've sprung it on me, but... Oh, the master, you know, but we'll go with Joe Canning until someone tells me different. I'm happy to go with Joe Canning.
Was Sean Purcell's nickname the master?
Yeah, the master. I mean, it's a pretty
good nickname. That is a good nickname, to be fair. That's even better than the Athenry Express.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a lot better than the Athenry Express.
Myself and Ciarán have been to his house. We've been to Joe Canning's house in Limerick. That might be a bombshell to some people who weren't aware that Joe is now living in Limerick. To meet the man, assess his golf game in his back garden, wolf down a packet of his chocolate hobnobs. We had a brilliant conversation about the John Feinstein book, A Good Walk Spoiled. We talked about Joe's own passion for golf. And we finally get the answer to the question. If there was a transfer system in the GAA, which county would Joe have moved to in a Megabucks move?
I gotta tell you, when you asked it, I was like, well, that's a stupid question. And then the answer was so good that
it's
I was like,
it's a great question.
Listen, don't come at McDevitt. He knows what he's doing, you know?
It sounded like a question he'd given great consideration to. More in the counties that he would never in a million years play for, rather than, you know, any county that he was dying to transfer to.
But if anyone has like even basic kind of County Galway geography, have a think about the county that Joe under no circumstances would ever join. But nevertheless, he delivers the answer with real aplomb.
To hear that chat and to hear Ken on Man United's victory over Liverpool yesterday, become a member, secondcaptains.com, a fiver a month plus VAT. We did not do it the easy way yesterday, Simon.
No, and do you ever get a feeling a few minutes into a game, one that you're at where you're in the stadium, whether it's like the atmosphere or the player's body language, or there's a few early errors, and you just think to yourself, this is going to be tight. Ireland are going to make loads of mistakes. Scots aren't going to go away. And actually, I was beside a Scottish journo who wasn't remotely concerned about the result, as in he just assumed Ireland were going to win, no matter what the scoreline, no matter where the teams were on the pitch. He was like, don't worry, Ireland are going to win, you know. Whereas I was kind of anxious throughout, and I think the crowd were quite anxious in the first half. And then the second half, it took off. You could tell the team, you could almost tell exactly what the team talk was at halftime. Be more direct, be more decisive, be more aggressive. And that really, really suited Ireland, actually, because they just were a little bit lethargic. They lacked focus. All those obvious things with the errors in the first half. And it really suited Robbie Henshaw in particular. Robbie, just go at them. Go hard, be aggressive. And I thought he had one of his best 40 minutes ever for Ireland. And that's saying something, because he's had some great games. And he kind of typified how we woke up, but also that we needed to be woken up. I think we needed that Farrell second half chat, which is kind of odd when you see how O'Mahony was in the warm-ups and the anthems, and obviously they were keyed up and wanted to do it for Peter and all that. So I don't think it was like taking Scotland for granted or anything like that. It was just a reality of, we just need to keep this simple for a little while. But I did feel as well, I got this feeling, are we an edgy team? Panic is the wrong word, but we seem to, in these tight games, go through a period where we just fall apart a little bit. Now, you could also argue we figure that out to an extent. We certainly did against Scotland. We kind of did against England, that we got ahead again. We kind of did against New Zealand, like better than previous teams. I'm thinking, you know, when it got edgy in previous World Cups or big Six Nations games, it was all over. Whereas Ireland are sort of coming back and figuring out to an extent to win some of these games, but we still have that historic edginess to it.
Yeah, come on. You're giving out that we weren't winning close games. Then we keep it close and we win. Now you're giving out that we were
edgy. Well, we reversed into that to make it a tight one. We had 22 visits to their 22. They made, what, 240 tackles. We utterly dominated them. And they were brilliant on their own line, defending on their own line. But we kind of kept them in it by not being very...
They were brilliant on their own line. The referee and the TMO was brilliant on their own line as well.
It was an odd game for the TMOs, wasn't it? Jumping in when they're much further away than the ref.
Murph, any thoughts on our latest Six Nations triumph?
Any thoughts? I mean, yeah, it was edgy, wasn't it? It's not for me to say that I predicted this one, but I did really think that Ireland weren't going to play very well and that Scotland just weren't going to be good enough to punish us. And I think that was really what happened. You know, that Ireland made so many mistakes that you'd have to think that a better team than Scotland probably would have been in pole position to actually really take advantage. Even the nature of the last 10 minutes, like the game is over and then suddenly it's not. And, you know, we're down to 14 and then there are injuries on the pitch and Scotland have possession. And, you know, a good team goes through five phases there. And, you know, when you look at Ringrose at that moment was down, Tadhg Byrne was down, and we were down to 14 men. I mean, if you're Scotland thinking of that, I mean, literally just take us through five phases there and don't drop the ball. And you're looking at a really, you know, like a devastating loss for this Ireland team, or at least the potential for it. So, I mean, it should never have gotten to that. And it's weird, you know, like so many of it is kind of like, well, this, so many of the conversations around this Irish rugby team are, this completely proves the opinion that I have of this Irish rugby team or the other. This game wasn't that, you know, it wasn't an emphatic kind of response to Twickenham or anything like it. But maybe it's just a more realistic view of this team. When you look at the Six Nations as a whole, you see us winning by five points in the end. We won a game against France that not a lot of people expected us to win. So maybe we ended up with the points total that a lot of people would have predicted. But it was by no means, you know, a vintage Six Nations quality-wise. I mean, in the end, like the last couple of weekends, I've actually had a ton of really good games. But it was still not a particularly high-quality Six Nations. And the best team in the Six Nations, like by a good distance, ended up winning the tournament. And we should be glad that it was us.
Yeah, Andy Farrell has noted the criticism from the likes of yourself, Murph. Here he is with Tommy Martin on Virgin. This is pre, and then we'll splice in a bit of post-match.
There was a bit of stick floating around this week, as there is after a defeat, for some individual players, for the group, and you know, even for the coaches as well. Has it been a difficult week, and how have you dealt with all that?
No, it's not been a difficult week, no, because we battened down the hatches. We're an honest group, you know.
There was a lot of criticism after the defeats during the week. Are you proud of how the team responded?
There was criticism from you before the game. Look, we don't...
It's felt like ages since we've had an Irish football manager getting needled by Tony O'Donoghue, so it's good that Tommy has stepped into the breach there. Fair questioning, to be honest, just when you listen back to what he asked pre-match. But it was interesting that Andy Farrell... I think it's also fair for Andy Farrell to store it up, because when you're looking visually at... How else do you look? When you're looking at Farrell pre-match, when Tommy Martin mentions the coach is getting criticism, at that stage Farrell sort of the eyebrow raises a little bit and you're like, he wants to say something here, but he held it in I think cleverly until post-match and has a little bite back. No problem. I've no problem with the approach of either men in what was a adult frank exchange of views.
Just men at it on. That's what we just heard there.
Yeah. Jesus. How do we veer into that territory? Let's get our guests in here.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is up because there's an incredible gun off here.
Yeah, my apartment's going to be stacked full of lads.
Probably 10 lads coming over
For the whole thing, so it's going to be absolute carnage.
Absolute carnage. We're stacked full of lads. We've got to be 10 lads coming absolute over. Carnage.
Simon, I don't know what you're doing toweling off there. Keep that top off and hit that bomb one more time.
Andrew Trimble with us today to celebrate a Six Nations title, even if this one isn't... I don't think this one's being as universally acclaimed as the ones that have gone before, but we are Six Nations champions once again. Andrew, how are you?
I'm great. I'm here to celebrate, but it feels like we need to supplement where we naturally feel emotionally, just with a remind ourselves that this is a Six Nations, but there's probably just that slight tinge of disappointment around it, I suppose.
Yeah, Chris Jones of BBC Rugby is with us again this week. Chris, how are you?
Yeah, really good. Great to be back. How are you guys?
Tom English from BBC Scotland. Tom, how are you?
Tip top on. Thanks.
So, Andrew, you said that we need to supplement it. Look, everyone knows it all went horribly wrong at Twickenham, the whole back-to-back Grand Slam, all that kind of stuff. How much does that colour how you're feeling today? Or do we have to just lay it out there that we've gone back-to-back Six Nations champions, which has not happened very often? That's happened twice before in Irish history.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. It's very important that we remember, I suppose, where we were before 09 and before just, you know, Grand Slams and Six Nations all happened very easily, and Six Nations Championship is still a huge accomplishment. Backing it up with this same team, but kind of bouncing back from the disappointment of the World Cup as well, something around that. So just that kind of middle ground, I suppose. I could probably go both directions. Just the fact that after the game, pundits and commentators have to say this is still a big deal rather than just naturally celebrating is kind of a reminder that just what happened at Twickenham slightly takes the edge off it.
Yeah, it was interesting because you guys were talking about that on Virgin, and I thought it was interesting. Shane was making the point that like the players will remember walking around with the medal more than they'll remember losing the Twickenham. Like, it's still a trophy, all that sort of stuff. And I think that's probably true. The players were absolutely jubilant. You could see it, and there's lots of great footage of the hours after they won. As well, they should be jubilant. It's maybe just more the Irish sporting, not just rugby, but sporting public in general. I think a lot of people, certainly judging by the backlash last week, a lot of people will probably remember the Twickenham defeat more than getting over the line against Scotland.
Maybe. I'm probably a good person actually to talk about this, because I've won a Six Nations, but I've never won a Grand Slam. Mm. And people often remember me kind of being part of something, some celebrations, and they say, "Oh yeah," they assume that I was a part of a Grand Slam. Maybe nobody on this call, nobody who kind of understands the rugby or kind of history of Irish performances or results on this call, but other people say, "Oh yeah," and then I have to have that awkward conversation where I say, "No, actually, I never won a Grand Slam," and they say, "Oh, hard luck," you know. But maybe that who would fall into that category now? Jack Crowley, Joe McCarthy. No doubt those guys will go on and correct that, and they'll be able to acknowledge, yes, we've won Grand Slams in the future. I'm sure those guys will. But it definitely does take something out of it. It shouldn't take away from the occasion or the moment. I don't think people will remember Twickenham as in the disappointment. They'll remember a reasonably successful year, but they'll not remember the fireworks of 18 or 09, the real kind of Grand Slam. But again, it probably supplements, maybe somewhere in between. If you go Six Nations Grand Slam here and Six Nations here, backing up the Grand Slam last year and the second in a row, it does make it more than just a championship, but it doesn't make it quite a Grand Slam. Is that fair?
Yeah, Chris, how would you assess this Irish side? Because they've been the most consistent team over a long period of time now. And I feel like, say, international rugby was a Premier League played over however many 30, 40 games, that Ireland would probably win that league. But then there's obviously big occasions like England and Twickenham or New Zealand in the World Cup where we don't play our best or don't necessarily win that game. But if you were to look at us as a longitudinal study, this is a really brilliant team. And consistency is what I suppose a lot of sports teams look for. It doesn't necessarily imply in rugby, but we are what is now a very consistent team, but not yet a great side. Is that fair?
Yeah, 100%. You know, the dominant force in European rugby, which given... You know, you've got teams like France and England with, you know, so much stuff going for them with their strong leagues and their resources. It's a brilliant achievement. I mean, it's all relative, isn't it, when you have these conversations about titles against slams. Of course, you remember those slams a little bit more. You know, Ireland fans remember O'Gara's drop goal and the win at Twickenham in 18, that little bit more. But that's because slams are so special. It doesn't mean titles aren't a brilliant achievement, especially, I think, in the modern day when every team is probably... competitive. You know, I know Wales have dropped off, but there were years, I don't know, 10, 15 ago where Italy, you could win that one in third gear, you could win Scotland in third gear. You've got to probably work for all your wins. But I do think this Ireland team have missed out on the chance of genuine greatness here. Mm. And that's perhaps why there was just that lingering sense of what might have been. And I was at the Aviva both for the Grand Slam last year and on Saturday for the Scotland game. And as Andrew outlines, the celebrations were quite markedly different. And there was almost a sense of the Ireland players trying to jolt themselves to go, no, this is special, this is special. And when you have to do that, I suppose you know it's not quite as special as the year before when everyone just knew it was special. And it's the context when Wales went back-to-back in 13, they lost their first game, went on a run, beat England 30-3. Jubilation. Ireland kind of started with a bang and then just started to tail off. They're still a brilliant side. I think there's great challenges that lie await for them. They could back up a win in South Africa, having won in New Zealand. But are they the greatest Six Nations team of all time? We can't quite say that yet. And that was perhaps what was at stake if they'd gone back to back with the Slam.
Yeah, Tom, I don't think we can say the greatest Six Nations team of all time. And the last two games... You could take it one or two ways. You could say it's kind of worrying the way the form went backwards. Maybe teams are working out our attack in particular. But then you could also say we grounded out. And it's funny, Chris, talking about players and maybe some of the media and the fans having to talk themselves into this being a great championship. The players had to be spoken to at halftime to how to deal with this Scottish team. The difference in Ireland in the second half was... kind of shocking, like just so much more aggressive, so much more direct. You could almost feel the team talk through the players as they came out after halftime.
Yeah, it was a huge difference. Like I'm not getting hung up on this whether they're the greatest Six Nations team of all time. I couldn't care less. You know, they've won a Grand Slam, they've won a championship. They kind of overcame their own shortcomings against Scotland. I didn't think Scotland or Ireland were great at all. And that game, they looked kind of flat, weirdly flat for the first 40. The Scotland were excellent defensively, really put it up to them. And they kind of fell over the line. But they got over the line, you know. I do think there's maybe a need for a refresh now. Peter Omani, is he going or is he staying? Sounds like he's going. there's an opportunity in this, maybe in the summer, maybe later on, to just bleed in some new players. Because you look at it, you know, the two scrum halves, Gibson Park 32, Murray 35 next month, Bielam and Healy, the backup props, 32 and 36. Bundy Aki will be 34 next month. You know, there's a chance maybe to start bringing in some freshness, because I think in the last two games, they looked a little bit tired, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely looked either low on energy or a little low on inspiration, or maybe just felt like they were on top of this Six Nations and got a bit of a shock against England, and that lingered for the first half against Scotland. I guess we'll never know the answer to that, but Andrew, there's a few things about it. I thought that the fact that we dealt with, you know, Sexton being gone, we lost Hugo Keenan, arguably our most consistent, arguably our most important back. We bedded in quite a few new players, like the likes of Joe McCarthy, and Nash did really well. Our scrum has been really, really good. Probably the best scrum of the Six Nations, which I don't think has ever happened before. But then worries too, as Tom touched on there, is our attack becoming a small bit predictable? How will you go to line out when it's struggling? Like, our stats were pretty good in the end, but in a game where you're being challenged, is there like a four man? Is there a fast, short one to O'Mahony? Whatever it is, we're struggling. Here's a line out that we can definitely get possession from. And then the other one there, like watching Gibson Park in the flesh over the last few weeks, he's a phenomenal rugby player. He's a joy to watch in every moment. He's so calm in like tight moments, when he's being tackled, when he's tackling, when he's at the back of a ruck. And I just feel like the drop off to Murray, and then maybe there's Casey or Caelan Blade or somebody like that. I used to think it was loose head prop, but now I actually think if we were to lose Gibson Park, it might change the whole pattern, the whole tempo of what we do.
Yeah, there's definitely something to that. Gibson Park, he adds something very, very special in terms of that pace, that nippiness, that ability to threaten around the edges, and then probably to a lesser extent, but pretty important as well, he allows Ireland to play that 6-2 because he does such an amazing job on the wing. He can also cover that and allow Ireland to have a couple of different options. It is quite difficult for Ireland to think creatively and be innovative and think, right, how do we solve this problem, whenever they haven't had that many problems to solve over the last couple of years. Everything they've touched turned to gold. Granted, quarterfinal, and yes, there's been, you know, a couple of moments, but generally they've been the best in town. They've been the best side around. If they turn up and they play the style of rugby that they played, they will usually be successful. It's hard to actually force yourself to say, right, let's remodel the line out. Let's look at what you're talking about with that front one, or let's be a bit more creative with their kicking game. And I think Scotland, because Scotland were so, so organized, they disrupted Ireland, but they didn't disrupt Ireland the way this England defense disrupted Ireland. They weren't just 100 miles an hour like Springboks, Felix Jones. They weren't disruptive in that way. They were just kind of a collective, organized. It was just the sort of defense that just eventually slow you down slightly, slow you down further, and then before you know it, you're in your shell and you look tired. Now, I think they were tired, but I think this Scottish defense just zapped the energy from them. They zapped the energy from themselves as well. So we didn't get to see Scotland. Really, they took themselves out of the game. 240 tackles took its toll on Ireland, but also took its toll on Scotland. I think whenever they got opportunities at the end, it never looked like the game was in the balance. But anyway, but back to Ireland. It did feel like the disappointing bit about the first half is that they went 40 minutes on the pitch and no one at any stage said, right, we need to be more confrontational, we need to be more direct, we need to out-muscle Scotland. If we continue to put on these long passes, Scotland will just absorb them, that we'll go side to side, we'll run out of energy. No one identified that. It's disappointing that it took them getting to the changing room to identify that and then fix that in the second half. But Simon, to your point, they completely fixed it and it completely solved all those problems. They became way, way more formidable and far bigger threat. And I wonder, you know, is that, you know, Peter Mahoney's, would he, you know, is it, maybe Johnny Sexton might have identified that in the past, you know, so definitely this team needs to learn. But it is remarkable how different the second half performance was to the first half. So they do have the ability to change things. Now, they're not changing, becoming more innovative, finding a new way to break down defense. They're just getting more direct and they're actually shortening up the passes and making the game less complicated. So it's, you know, it's not like hats off, well done, lads, you've really discovered something. And the problem with them, with that solution,
that's exactly what I thought, yeah,
they can't go to that solution in South Africa. That's not an option. You don't say, right, let's get more direct, because that's going to get, it's going to be more difficult to get on top. So it's good that they can go there. They have a plan B. They can think on their feet, or, well, certainly whenever they speak to the coaches, they can change that. But it'll take more whenever they go to South Africa. So this is good for them. What I was saying before was, because they've been always dominant, it's hard to revamp that or shake that up, but they have to shake that up. And I think it's a good place to be because of the big challenge that awaits them in South Africa.
Andrew, what did you make of Jack Crowley over the course of the championship?
The best version of Jack Crowley is whenever he plays off instinct. And that's also the worst bit of him, because we saw him playing off instinct in the first game against France, and he put that little grubber through. He went for, you know, touchline, you know, tried to find space in the corners and charged down a couple of times. So he's got that natural flair, and it's brilliant. It's important, and he looks confident even by his body language. People follow him because he just looks like a guy who is a natural leader. But you want that flair to kind of mature a little bit. As we've seen, maybe Finn Russell is a good example of that flair kind of maturing over the last number of weeks. But we also haven't seen the fireworks from Finn Russell, and we've seen probably less of that from Jack Crowley as well. So that's just him and his mindset and just maturing, but not losing what makes him very, very special. I think he looks ever so slightly, and we're nitpicking here. The good bit is the debate is put to bed. Jack Crowley is 100% the future at 10 for Ireland, and that was in the balance 8 weeks ago. So that's great news, and he deserves that, because he's led this team very well. He's looked ever so slightly indecisive, I think, at times, and I think he's thinking about what people maybe expect from him managing a game. Think, you know, be mature and just layer up on top of that, you know, talented, you know, kind of skill set that he has. He's looked slightly indecisive at the line a couple of times, putting the ball through and changing his mind once or twice, and it leads to mistakes. He's also looked a little bit indecisive in the backfield, and, you know, George Ford's a good example of this. He looks the picture of composure in the backfield. He manages that backfield for England so well. I don't think Jack Crowley's there yet. I think he's got a good bit to go in that area. But generally, I think he's got a huge future. I think he's going to be massive for us. Continue to invest in him, and he will become the George Ford. Maybe not quite the Johnny Sexton at some stage, but that's a very, very high bar to reach. I think he will continue to grow. I think he's definitely our 10 at the minute, and for the foreseeable long-term future, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, that 8 weeks ago we didn't know for sure he was first choice, but there's a fair distance between him and the rest at the moment. And Chris, Farrell was actually interesting on Crowley after the game. He said, "Jack's a realist, and do you know what? I've been hard on him. We have. Jack will tell you that, because it's easy to read the press with you guys and get carried away with that. But we've kept his feet on the ground, because there has to be a realization that this is not it. That's not what we are chasing. We are chasing something better than that. And as long as we can continue to do that, we'll continue to grow as a group."
Yeah, it looks like pretty sound management. I think the part of it with the post-Sexton era is finding someone, getting them some experience, and then sticking with them, isn't it? Because looking from the other side of the Irish Sea, it felt as if there was always kind of a new Sexton being anointed. Or not a new Sexton, but an heir to Sexton being anointed. You know, whether it was Ross Byrne or Harry Byrne or whoever it might have been. So if Crowley is the man, and I think that game in Marseille really established himself as a high quality test 10, then that's going to be great for Ireland going forward. It just is going to be that question of him at the start of his international career, how much he can drive the team tactically. More onus then falls on Gibson Park and Aki, but as we've discussed, they've not got years and years left, and there's not a huge amount of depth of scrum half. And then that leadership question again, to like Andrew said, we're probably nitpicking here, but if Peter Armani's done, then it looks like Caelan Doris will be the next captain. But then there's just a new leadership group's going to have to emerge, but a leadership group that really can dominate in terms of making tactical decisions on the pitch and not relying on the messaging from the coaches at halftime. We have this thing in England for sure. Like, younger players are brilliant athletes, they're great lads, but, you know, do they have that kind of rugby IQ in this professional age where they've had stuff coached into them since the age of day dot? That's something for, I think, Ireland to contend with. Look, we don't know a huge amount about guys like Van der Flier and Doris. They seem good boys. They're obviously wicked players, but they're such low media profiles and don't talk too much when on Ireland duties. You never really get a sense of their personality. So I'm just really, really interested in how this new Irish leadership core emerges from Leinster, especially because they obviously have had so much of that leadership coming from Johnny Sexton and latterly Peter Armani.
Yeah, Tom, what do you make of that? The idea, I think Crowley actually has had a really good Six Nations. He's a brilliant when he runs with the ball. He looks excellent. He looks dangerous. His passing has been really good. His general skill levels. He's taken many up and unders from full back. His long kicking game is good. His penalty taking is pretty much held up besides one game.
Well, 74%. That's got to cut it. You know, Finn Russell's at 95%. For example.
Yeah, but Russell's freakish in the Six Nations. He's kind of miles above the rest. But
that's unusual for Russell as well to be that high. You know, that's.
Yeah. But you do want to be nailing. Yeah, you want to be nailing more of your kicks. But fairness, we mentioned this politely, Simon, after the France game, and had a few Munster fans down our throats saying, "Give the lad a chance," which is absolutely what we're going to do. What everyone's going to do. Like Sexton and O'Gara took a little bit of betting in as well before everything came together. So I suppose as long as his overall game is good enough, you'd presume the penalties he'll push those percentages up.
Yeah, I'm not worried about that side of things, and I think he's had a really good Six Nations. But what do you think, Tom, overall about this idea? So when I look at England and France, I feel like obviously the Six Nations got better, and if they were to look at their trajectory, they'd be pretty happy, whereas Ireland's form tapered off. And then there's a few positions that you think, well, going ahead, obviously Omani's the obvious one, but how much more time is there in Furlong and Gibson Park, and that feeling of leadership that Chris touched on there, and who would take over?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Alan Crowley, I agree. I think he's had a terrific Six Nations. And I think if you know, the burden of taking over from Sexton was in his head. I don't know if it was or wasn't, but if that was a thing with him, I don't think it should be a thing anymore, because he's come in, he's proven himself. And I think the Sexton thing is gone now. It's done. Ireland have won a championship without Sexton, and Crowley could kick on. The leadership thing, you know, there are good leaders in this. I think they're in this group. They may not be big media personalities, but I think they're good stand-up guys. There's no question that Ireland need a kind of a little bit of a refresh, not a massive refresh. And there's no question either that England are coming. They're a very young team, a lot of young players. They are coming. Their under-20s are good. There's a guys 22, 23, 24 starting for this England test team right now and playing exceptionally well. France, the same. So this Six Nations is going to be very different to the next Six Nations, I suspect, because England, I suspect, will turn up from the start. I think France will turn up from the start. And I think Ireland will turn up as well. So I think next season's Six Nations could be a thriller. I don't. We just got over the last one. I think Ireland could look a bit different. I can't imagine O'Mahony to be around in a year's time. So it could look a little bit different. Ireland have younger players to come through. That's in a way. I'm delighted that they're going to South Africa, but in a way, I'd like to see them take on a less arduous tour, so that they could maybe bleed in some of the younger players. I don't think they're going to have that opportunity on this tour.
Yeah, Farrell loves these arduous tours, though, doesn't he, Tom? This is part of his deal, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Just the more brutal, the better. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting 12 months to see what this Ireland team looks like this time next year.
We've touched on O'Mahony a couple of times there, Andrew. How do you think he handled the emotion of the occasion, which was visible, really, you know, for him that weekend?
Yeah, it was a big moment for him. I know he, after the game, he said he would go away and speak to family. I would imagine he's spoken to family, and he's already had those conversations. It certainly, by the way, he was emotionally in the anthem. It looked very much like it was his last game. Who knows? I mean, and he's probably left the door open there just in case. And he'd probably read Farrell in this. If Farrell, I know there was a conversation with Keith Earls on the way up to the World Cup, where Ozzy was kind of close to going one direction or another, and Farrell convinced him to come out. So speak to family, speak to friends, but speak to Farrell and see how much he needs you or wants you to have that experience on tour. Pete, we've got used to kind of the kind of straight face Pete, the leader, and the, you know, kind of grumpy, you know, he's that sort of a profile, but he's all very much got an emotional side, and, you know, playing for this team absolutely means the world for him and his family. And he's been a huge, you know, huge talisman for Ireland for an awful long time, and he deserved, I think there was an awful lot of what happened at the weekend. Actually, you know, maybe that was a big part of it. You know, there was a slight tinge, okay, that this isn't what it could have been, but we've made, you know, some memories here with Pete and Tadhg Furlong and everything that happened there as well. So it was a very, very human moment for the two of them, and a nice one for everybody to kind of get behind and create a special memory for Pete and Tadhg as well, obviously, to kind of what has been a tough period of time for him to be part of that as well.
Yeah, just on Tadhg Furlong, if people don't know what happened there, unfortunately, Tadhg lost his father. His dad, James, died in December, just gone. So that's why it was particularly poignant that he shared the trophy lift with Peter O'Mahony. You wanted to come in there, Tom.
Sorry, yeah. So you spend a lot of time around these guys. Are you concerned, say if O'Mahony is going, Sexton is obviously gone, two incredible leaders. Are you concerned at all about the leadership function? Because I'm underplaying it, but I'm not exactly panicking there.
I'm not actually, because we spent 8 years worrying about the end of Sexton's career. What'll we do? Fretting over it on a weekly basis, bored ourselves with the chat about it. And then we've dealt pretty well with Crowley, who hadn't played much for Munster, never mind Ireland, comes in and does, picking apart errors and stuff like that. Sexton was making errors right up to the end of his career. O'Gara made a ton of errors in World Cups and elsewhere. Out-halves make errors. Finn Russell makes errors, and he's maybe the best out-half, or arguably the best out-half in the Six Nations at the moment. So I'm not too worried about the leadership side of it. There's loads of strong characters. Like Bundy, it's funny, the crowd like really got into it in the second half, Andrew. When you're in the stadium, you felt it. You know, I wasn't sure how much in the first half they really cared, and then the second half it became apparent that maybe it was nerves in the first half and all the rest of it. But Bundy says nothing ever to anybody, and he's immensely popular. He doesn't need to say anything because, I guess, just the way he plays, and he's so ultra consistent. And I actually think that sort of consistent player, you know, Furlong and Sheehan and all these guys and Gibson Park, that's kind of leadership to me. I kind of hate the word because there's so much corporate babble speak about it, and it sometimes gets incorporated into rugby as well, and people try and, I don't know, compare the two. So there's a lot of shit talk about leadership, but I actually think it's the way you play. And I think the most important thing for O'Mahony is actually the way he played in the final game, never mind, you know, crying during the anthem or and these are nice gestures, you know, helping Furlong lift the cup, all that sort of stuff, that's all great, but actually the way he played was pretty good, and I think will be the main memory and main thing he'll be proud of if it is his last game. But I just wanted to ask you, Chris, about the overall quality of the Six Nations. I've heard this on Irish TV a few times, actually not Andrew Trimble, funny enough, but that this was a low quality Six Nations, which I honestly have heard every year for the last 30 years. And looking at France, England, or the quality some of Italy's attack and play, or some of the tries Ireland scored, to say it's a low quality Six Nations, I don't get it. But what do you reckon?
No, I don't buy that either. I think you're right. Sometimes there is this kind of temptation to say everything's low quality, and yeah, you get some stinkers. Of course you do. Like, I don't think the second half of France Scotland was up to much. You know, England Wales, I probably overplayed at the time. I thought it was a really good contest. Looking back, the scrums were painful and sort of sucked a lot of life out of it. But I thought Scotland England was loads of fun. I thought Scotland Wales was loads of fun. And then in terms of quality, I thought England Ireland, I thought the quality was outstanding. Like, yes, Scotland Wales was fun, and it was 20 odd points. But in terms of the perfect kind of amalgamation of intensity, physicality, and all those kind of the physical side of rugby that we love, allied with the skill and the quality and the it's ultimately accuracy the fans want to see. They want to see the best players implement their skills as well as possible. And as a fan, you want to look at it and go, man, I couldn't dream of doing that. And when you see Scotland and England coughing up a million balls at Murrayfield, you go, well, I can cough a ball up. You know, so I don't need to watch someone else do it. Then you watch England, Ireland, and then you watch France, England. You go, okay, that's proper quality rugby. So, of course, not every game was perfect, but I think rounds 4 and 5, we've got some stunning rugby. And it's a hard tournament to talk about in the round because we have a dominant team in Ireland, but we don't have a Grand Slam team. So, therefore, all the narratives about that team. So it's hard to know what is the story out of this Six Nations. You could argue there are like four. There's Ireland going back to back. There's England's suddenly out of nowhere newfound attacking intent, scoring some tries from the gods we didn't know they were going to score. It's Italy's best ever championship, making sure this talk about them being in the tournament's put to bed, and it is they've well and truly arrived, a bit belatedly, but they're there now. And it's Wales going back or being in the doldrums. There's kind of four big themes have emerged from this Six Nations. So if not vintage, if not the best ever, there wasn't the final day jeopardy, I think, to make it one of the best ever. But I still thought it was a great Six Nations that kept us royally entertained and seemed to get better and better towards the end as well.
I mean, I think the poor quality argument relates to weeks 1 to 3, because if you look at it, France hadn't turned up yet, really. England hadn't turned up, really. And Wales, well, they never turned up. So there were good games, but you're talking France and England, two of the big hitters, were poor, but they found themselves spectacularly. That's why weeks 4 and 5 were incredible and kind of saved the entire tournament. It looked after 3 weeks, and I'd said it, but Ireland could stroll to a Grand Slam here, which should never happen.
Never stroll to a Slam.
And it didn't happen. So I think weeks 4 and 5 were spectacular. We saw amazing games. We saw, you know, Ireland getting over the line back to back, as you say, Chris. France and England doing a Lazarus mid-tournament. Scotland consistent and entertaining in their maddening inconsistency. Italy, for me, are the story of the tournament. And Wales, a dramatic story of the tournament in itself, almost.
Tom, I think Scotland is the one confusing one. I think we know where everybody is. England and France, as you say, okay, right. DuPont and Ntamack come back for France. England are going to kick on. They're going to get, both those teams are going to get better. And I agree. Next year is going to be amazing because of that. Wales are struggling. They're in dire straits. We know where they are. Italy, brilliant. We're excited. Scotland's the one I'm going, this is so Scottish. We just don't know where they are. And they're the one that is most confusing, I feel, Tom.
Yeah, they are where they have been for quite a while, Andrew. They're kind of in no man's land. They don't know where they are. So I don't know how the rest of us are supposed to know where they are. You know, all of the tries scored, tries conceded, points for, points against, penalty count, all of those have gone down year on year. The penalty count was 57-27 against them this season. Astonishing gap. You know, we've seen a few players come through. Andy Christie has been terrific. Seen some players going backwards. 2 wins out of 5. It was 3 wins out of 5 last season. They were very unlucky against France with that last try that wasn't given, but they still should have won the game. They had the game in Italy in the palm of their hand, 3 tries after 28 minutes, and they blew it. They imploded. Now, if Scotland had won against Italy, as they should have done, and then lost the way they lost in Ireland, I think everyone here would go, do you know what? That's a good championship. But it's their capacity, Andrew, to throw in an absolute dud, a flaky performance that is really, really annoying. The Scottish rugby public, you just, when you get to the point where you're going to trust them, they throw in a performance like that and you think, oh my God, nothing has changed here.
Yeah, and I think Gregor Townsend needs to have a look at his halftime team talks, because against France, against Italy and against Ireland, they're looking okay at halftime or really good at halftime, and then having just a total slump.
Well, they seem to play the wrong strategy. Like they, against France, they went into their shell conservatively, which probably played into France's hands because they'll kick the ball back to you all day, France. And then Italy, they wanted to play this like Jouer rugby throughout, which then offered up mistakes to Italy to get back in the game. So tactically, it seems like when you want them to be conservative, they're open. And when you want them to be open, they're conservative.
Yeah. Chris, who do you feel deep down, when the results have settled in a few months' time, we're looking back at the Six Nations, which team will feel most satisfied with themselves?
Probably going to sound weird. I'm going to say England, but obviously with the caveat that Ireland have won the championship, we've got to keep remembering where they were beforehand, and those of us, I was one of them saying, look, life after Sexton could be tough. They'll take a beating in Marseille, and then how are they going to react as Johnny Sextonless Ireland? So the fact they didn't get a beating in Marseille, they wiped the floor of France, then have kicked on to win the championship, albeit not without a slam. So look, Ireland are going to feel happy with life. I just think there are questions for Ireland going forward because of the way their final performance was not as strong as their first performance. Whereas because England, in that middle, after Murrayfield, you were like, oh man, this tournament's going to unravel, because they've got Ireland coming to Twickenham, then they're going to Bear Pit in Lyon. They're going to be 2 from 5 for the 4th successive championship, and all of that goodwill from the World Cup reaching third place, that'll be dissipated because England fans go, hold on, kicked and clapped your way to bronze medal. promises of new beginnings in the Six Nations not happened. And I do think there would have been some kind of inquest going on around Twickenham today if it had unravelled as some foresaw. The fact that it didn't, they not only played really well against Ireland, but beat Ireland, took their biggest scalp in at least 3 years, maybe more, maybe going back all the way to the World Cup in 19. And then there, look, they lost to France, but there wasn't anything on the line in terms of titles. And it's a point game, but they scored four tries and went toe-to-toe with France away from home. And a French side who looked a little bit resurgent. So I think England are really, out of nowhere, in a really healthy place. I think the performances have breathed life into the Steve Borthwick regime, really given a massive boost to their attacking game and Richard Wigglesworth. George Ford looks, as you know, as always, we know he's such a class act at 10, but he's established himself there. And they've got this phalanx of younger players in their mid-20s, even lower, who have announced themselves on the test stage, whether that's Ben Earl or Chesham or Martin or Faye Wiboso or Ollie Lawrence or whoever it might be. You know, Tommy Freeman's a good example. That they've been great. So the challenge for England now, they go back to their clubs, they do all their different things. Some will be in a Premiership run-in, some will be in kind of mid-table wilderness. Some will be in the Champions Cup knockout. Some will be twiddling their thumbs on European weekends. Then they need to get back together and not take 6-7 weeks to start functioning. How do they get into camp ahead of the New Zealand tour and suddenly hit the ground running, suddenly drop into a template like the Ireland guys can do when they just drop in and probably within, you know, Andrew could testify, they're probably within an hour of training. They're right back in Ireland headspace, Ireland calls, Ireland this, Ireland that. For England, it just has always taken so, so, so long. Have they got something now where it doesn't take so long? They actually do have, you know, a default pattern from which to operate defensively and attacking wise. If they have, they could go and cause an upset in New Zealand, and then the future of English rugby looks really bright. The 20s won the Six Nations as well. So, yeah, long answer to your question. I think England are going to feel pretty happy with life, but Ireland won the championship, and as Tom says, Italy were the big story because they were absolutely sensational too.
Oh, yeah, Italy have to be feeling best, I think, out of any team. It's the best ever before. It feels harsh on them that they still finished second bottom, you know. It feels like they were better than that.
Do you guys take much notice of the table outside winning?
Except like, number one, Chris.
Yeah, of course. Number one counts. But when 2, 3, 4, and 5 have all got roughly the same number of wins, yeah, and someone goes, oh, you know, you're fifth on points. Come on. I don't think that really matters. Like Italy.
There's no way France feel like, yeah, we're second best in Europe. We feel great. Mm-hmm.
2 wins and a draw for Italy. They are way happier about life than Scotland are right now.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I tell you, one country that does look at the table is Scotland. Absolutely, they look at the table. And I can understand, I agree with everything else you're saying about England don't need to look at the table. France don't need to look at the table. Italy, certainly, you know, they don't need to look at the table. Scotland had a chance to finish second. They'd never finished second before. And they blew it. And they ended up fourth. So that is relevant. That is relevant to them, specifically to Scotland, I think. It's a crusher. I know that Scotland were excellent in defensively. But
that's decades of not winning stuff, isn't it, Tom?
Like second would be a triumph. Would have been a triumph. And it would have been a significant shot in the arm for Scotland. It would have signified real progress, even if it was 3 wins out of 5, which they've had a number of times before in recent years. But second place would have felt like a big step forward. Fourth place is a step backwards for me, especially if you see the way their attacking game has kind of disintegrated, really.
Andrew, do you feel, I felt this during the Scotland game and the England game, that Ireland are still, for how good they are and how good their results have been and all these wins at home and all the records they've broken for themselves, that we're still like a surprisingly edgy team when the pressure comes on?
This Irish side, I feel like, generally, so, you know, we were talking about Scotland there, and sometimes having that habit and that history leads you to continue to behave the way you've always behaved. At Twickenham, Ireland were, you know, 6 out of 10 and very nearly beat. You know, England performed really, really well that day and, you know, just managed to pluck it out of the fire, but it was a last minute drop goal. You know, this Irish side, despite maybe drops in their performances, you know, an inability to really get a foothold in the game in the first half against Scotland, they usually find a way. I suppose that's something you can't really control. That's something that is inherent, and you develop that through, you know, 12, 18, 24 months of consistent performances and consistent results. That's what's very special about this Irish team, even though a lot of things don't necessarily go their way. We weren't blown away by a lot of the performances in the Six Nations, but they still have that. Now they're going to South Africa in the summer. So a lot of all this, you know, there's an asterisk beside it. A lot of all that, okay, South Africa do that, but they do that better. South Africa is going to be another level altogether. So I think it's going to be very difficult for Ireland. So do you think there is an element of they can rely on that historical performance or that historical ability to pull results out of the fire? When you go to South Africa, it's a different story altogether. So I think it's perfect that Ireland have this challenge ahead of themselves where they can tap into, hopefully, they can find a way to tap into something new.
Chris, do you think Ireland are an edgy team still, in spite of all the success?
No, I don't think so. I think every team can get put under pressure. You know, the great All Blacks team of the last 15, 20 years, you can rattle anyone. This is always why I was reluctant to write England off at Twickenham, because when you're at home and you've got the crowd with you and you put teams under pressure and the crowd get into the game, like, anything can happen. Anyone can act as humans. Now, you could really look through Ireland's two defeats and go, well, every time they have been put under pressure, New Zealand quarterfinal, England, they've not had an answer. They've lost. But, you know, they will occasionally drop games. That is going to happen. Not every team just constantly wins. I think it was amazing. The tries they scored, sometimes with a man down or with Gibson Park on the wing making the extra man. You know, the second low try, how they've done that with their scrum half having to link was brilliant at Twickenham. So, no, I wouldn't be massively concerned about the games they've lost and how they've lost. The concern more for me would be, look, this Ireland team's been together a while. They've played the same style of play for a while. Defensive coach is going to be poring over it. There were just signs in the Scotland game, they weren't executing with their usual efficiency. If they then lose in South Africa, which is possible because, man, it's playing away in South Africa at the end of a long season, then they've got New Zealand back at home and then an autumn. And it just is, not every team can stay on top for long. We were eulogising about Ireland in 2018, and this Ireland team is probably better than that, but they fell off a cliff through 2019, didn't they? So they've just got to avoid that happening, because they're probably at their, what could be their apex now of performance. How do they make sure they can continue to stay there and be one of these consistently winning teams that can win in South Africa, that can win three in a row? Not worry about the World Cup. That's way, way, way too far off. But I'm just really fascinated to see where they go forward and whether they've got any more improvement in them, where they can get even better from where they are now.
Yeah,
I think you look at it, this is purely with the benefit of hindsight, because I thought Ireland would beat England comfortably and I thought Ireland would beat Scotland comfortably. But you look at both of those games, England were on the back of a shocking performance at Murrayfield. They were furious. And they brought that fury to bear at Twickenham. Scotland, similarly, on the back of a shocker in Rome. And on the back of 9 defeats in a row against Ireland, the last one of which was a total embarrassment in Paris. So they brought that fury as well. So Ireland came up against a lot of anger in both.
The boxer angry, the world number one chat.
they're permanently angry. They're nothing to be angry about, but they're angry anyway.
Yeah, people calling Ireland the best in the world made them their fury.
Oh, completely. And also, I mean, the fact that they have the confidence of winning the World Cup while also having the chip on their shoulder and also being beaten by us in the opening set. Psychologically, that is well set up for South Africa. You'd have to worry about that. We'll leave that for the time being, though, lads. Listen, great stuff today. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having us. Cheers.
Cheers, folks.
From Ireland's Second Captain Show. Second Captain Show.
Oh, yeah. It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein. Protein.
This is not a dig at football people who know the game.
No respect, no honour.
What's the respect of my day?
Dog shit is bad on.
But who plays rugby?
I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a
corner
movie.
No, they don't.
But
they
no.
Do.
Sorry,
they do not.
Down
the balls.
Shut up, the two of you. I just want to play commentary at a goal.
Fire up and I go!
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like Nick.
You get the ball forward, you compete, you chase people, you close people down, you create excitement, you win balls when you shouldn't win balls, you commit yourself to the game.
It has not been a good Six Nations for our old friend Gatty, Warren Gatland. A wooden spoon for Wales. 5 defeats last week. Didn't he walk out of an interview last week before the interview even happened?
It was taking a few seconds too long to come to him, and you could just tell he was seething, and then he just walked out before it happened. Yeah,
that was one of those clips where, to be honest, I saw it on mute on Twitter. I wasn't actually sure entirely what had happened, but you could kind of see. So it's one of those where he's waiting for the TV to come to him, and it's just a few seconds too long. He's like,
which is the norm. Like they always have
completely.
To wait there.
I mean, he'd be more than happy if he was on the verge of a Grand Slam to stay. As would Eddie Goach.
I'll tell you what. When I was doing the sideline reporting for News Talk in like 2010 or 2011.
Thanks for coming.
I do remember being on the far side of Croke Park, on the Kyzikstad side of Croke Park, with Kieran McGeaney after Kildare had lost an All-Ireland quarterfinal, right? And so the whole technological side of things was fairly rudimentary. So my main method of communication with the commentary box was for me to wave frantically with my microphone in the air at someone who's like 100 yards away across the pitch and up in the upper deck of the Hogan Stand. And I was stood there with Kieran McGeaney for 2.5 minutes. And it was the longest 2.5 minutes of my entire life. And he was just staring at me with his eyebrow raised. I don't know if you've seen Kieran McGeaney's facial expressions. He does raise his eyebrows in a way that is, you know, quite intimidating.
Yeah.
So in the end, I it was actually me that called it off in the end. I was like, Kieran, I can't keep you here any longer. I'm sorry. Just please.
I cannot believe it. You chickened out of the...
It's just manners. It's just manners, hon. You know, there's only so long you could ask a losing manager to hang around before you just have to say, listen, be on your way.
Well, Warren Gatland completed his post-match press duties after losing to Italy at the weekend, and here's a little bit of what he had to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I've made that commitment, but that's like I just said to Abby and the change rooms. I said, look, if you want me to resign, I'm happy to do that. And she said, like hell. She said, the last thing I want. She said, that's what I'm really afraid of. But I can promise you that we'll go away and we'll make sure that we review this really, really carefully. We've already done some review stuff and work on the areas that we really need to get better at and improve.
Bit of a humble brag there, just, you know, they want me to stay. The last thing they want me to do is walk away, which is probably true. I mean, like, you know, who are they going to get in that's a better coach than Warren Gatland? I don't know. I just still don't know why he went back there. He obviously saw something and thought he could work some sort of miracle, but it's been a nightmare, really. There's something else went on actually at the weekend in this game. There's a little altercation between one of his coaching staff, Neil Jenkins, and the referee. Jenkins is on as the water boy, but has a little bit too much to say for himself.
No, your job is to bring the water.
Your job is to ref the game.
Yeah, man, your job is to bring the water on it. Yeah, come here, please. That's the second time you talk to me. I don't
accept that. Blue 9, high tackle. Our staff are saying it. Blue 9, high tackle.
Wait, come here, please. That's the last time. Next time, you cannot enter on the field. You understand?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so all is not well with Wales this year, Simon, it's fair to say.
They're just having the worst time. It's the worst Welsh team probably ever. They were bad in the 90s, but this is worse. And when you look at their under 20s and their regions and all that sort of stuff,
Reece Samet leaving before the thing and all that kind of stuff,
you know? Yeah, and I think there are big, Murph said earlier in the show about this being a low quality Six Nations. I think Wales are a big reason for people thinking that way, because England were actually pretty good at the end, France were good by the end, Ireland were pretty good throughout besides the England game and half the Scotland game. Italy were their best ever. Scotland were kind of the level they're always at, which is still a good Scotland team by historical context.
But, bottom half of the Six Nations again this year, Simon?
Exactly. Is it fourth, is it?
Yeah, fourth again.
Yep. But I think Wales, who were, you know, the best team for a decade or so under Gatland, or one of them, them being so bad makes you think the Six Nations is worse than it was. And I don't actually agree with it being a really low level Six Nations. People say that every year, literally every year. I think the time of year, the weather, the fact that teams are coming straight out of the club season, generally you'll get loads of errors and the pressure and all that sort of stuff. And people just immediately jump to this is a low level Six Nations. Or if one of the top teams isn't playing well, this is a low level Six Nations. I was actually tweeting about this over the weekend. All those slams in Six Nations that Wales and England in particular won over the decades, they were playing against shite Ireland and Scottish teams. It's just changed the teams who were good and bad. That's the only difference. There's always one team who's terrible. There's always a team who's kind of the best and then a load in the middle who beat each other and one does well at home and bad away and all the rest of it. I think it's the Six Nations kind of the way it's always been. And actually, if you compare it to North-South and the difference between the teams, the fact that Ireland and France are so good now and so close to South Africa and New Zealand. And England, I think, have joined that group as sort of, it's not a top four anymore, it's a top five. So I think Ireland have won a reasonable Six Nations. I don't think it was any weaker than any other year.
The football podcast will be available for World Service members tomorrow. Golf Chat with Joe Canning coming up this week and loads of other good stuff. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Si.
Thanks, Ellen. Thanks, Murph.
Thanks, Emil, for listening. Chat soon.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
World Service.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.